Lend me your ears. The Oral Dramaturgies Podcast. The Salon. Conversations about sound.
Hello, welcome to The Salon. Our guests today are Daniela Mandic and Sara Ramshaw, who share research interests at the intersection of the legal and the sonic. Daniela Mandic is a senior lecturer in law at the University of Westminster in London. He is a co-editor of the Law and the Senses series at the University of Westminster Press. His research interests include copyright law, art law, law and technology, sound studies, aesthetics of law, and popular culture. Sara Ramshaw has been an associate professor at the University of Victoria Faculty of Law in British Columbia, Canada, since 2017, following appointments at Queen's University Belfast School of Law in Northern Ireland and the University of Exeter School of Law, England. Her research interests fall broadly in the area of arts-based approaches to law, with a specific focus on the improvisatory arts, especially music, dance, and theatre. In their Salon conversation, Sara and Daniela discuss the relationship between law, sound, and listening, looking into concepts such as law and justice, structure and form, listening and hearing, improvisation and composition, and machine listening. The two question the similitude of sound and law, focusing on the elusive and material qualities of both. They think about attentive listening as a condition of justice, and about the capacity of law to listen and or hear. This conversation was recorded on Zoom on the 21st of October 2020 between London and Victoria.
It's very nice that we can actually have this sort of chat that is ongoing directly or indirectly, or maybe we actually do engage through various sort of discourses that we belong to or we are maybe external to, but somehow really this notion or the idea of law, sound, listening becoming not only quite present, but especially in your work, they have always been implicitly and explicitly present. Shall we start from sound or shall we start from law? Or shall we start somewhere completely?
That's a very good question.
Yeah, it's Let's think about sound. Maybe let's start just generally about sound and what sound is and how sound relates to law and justice. And I certainly think about your work. And of course, at one point, we'll have to address the notion of improvisation and what it means. So how do you approach sound? What is sound for you?
Perhaps in my work, I don't really address sound per se, because I'm coming to sound through listening and attunement, or attunement as an imperfect listening, so an always straining towards an other sound that can never be heard, but it is the, I guess, the movement or the process of the straining that is important. So I feel a bit of a fraud being on a podcast about sound, because although I'm starting to engage with a lot of the sound studies work, I still am a very amateur in terms of my knowledge. But I do feel that, especially in relation to the research I've done in the past, that listening is one of the most important aspects about law and justice, and therefore trying to work through that. And I think you can't really have listening without sound.
Exactly.
But that's a question.
No, but that's exactly what I, even though you're not directly, you're right, engaging with it, I think it's always quite present. And especially in your, I'm kind of referring now to the notion of improvisation that you've been using, not only in terms of music improvisation and questioning what composition is, what improvisation is in context of law and justice, but also in terms of improvisation in context of theater. And I think once we kind of position ourselves in that sort of environment, the act of listening and the very thing or matter that we are listening to is actually directly related to sound, I think.
I don't, they're not coming from my end. these interesting sound effects. Oh,
did you
fireworks?
Hear them?
Oh,
yes,
is
fireworks.
That, is that? Oh my
yeah,
goodness!
That was good. Yeah, actually, no, it's perfect. It was, you know, there was a bit of a silence, and they often
is
say,
"Is it Guy
like,
Fawkes Night? Is that what it is?
It's about to be right."
So that, oh my god!
It's about to actually take place. Oh. Yeah, there was a very interesting silence in that sense, but then they interrupted very interestingly.
Can I ask you a question? Because it's
yes,
been,
maybe. Yeah, maybe you can.
Okay, sorry. It's in relation to, so Danila has written a beautiful piece for this special issue that I'm co-editing in Law, Text, Culture on Acoustics of Justice. And he's writing in terms of this artist, Robert Morris. The title is Box with a Sound of Its Own Making. And I just wonder if you could speak to how you relate this artistic sculpture slash sound work to law. But also one thing that I've been curious about since reading it is why sound? You can explain to the listeners, you know, what was done. Basically, it's an audio recording of this box being made. But why sound as opposed to video, let's say, or showing the video of the box being made? I'm not familiar with why Morris's choices in regard to this. And I was wondering if you could, you know, talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, probably I can. It's very interesting. Well, I probably wouldn't be able to answer why sound, because the work is, the title already explains, and it's one of the seminal works that was made in the beginning of the 60s, and it comes from this minimalist movement that actually, it was using essential geometric forms, but also it had an aim to actually challenge the tradition of representation and actually, as the title says, the box with the sound of its own making. It's an amazing and probably one of the first sort of, or they argue it's the first sound sculpture or sculpture of sound in a sense that actually brings the medium of sound as a particular matter that actually creates the box. So it kind of plays with what one hears and what one sees in front of them, because the way in which it's exhibited, actually you see the box and also you hear the sound of its own making. So it kind of challenges and engages with those sort of notions of representation, but also it engages with what is there or not. It engages with past and present, but also with future, but also by having it as a standing on a pedestal, right? Or it just kind of, it's very static in its own form, but there is a sound that we can hear. I certainly use the analogy, or at least for me, that sort of analogy is quite lucid in the sense that that sort of stillness, that presence actually resonates with what law is, because in my view, law certainly constantly, even though it's still and creates this sort of norm, authority, standing, being almost silent, actually this box allows or provides an entry point for one to think about law with a sound of its own making. That means that the extent to which law, in its most general sense, carries within itself a sonic quality. But then we have to contextualize this because there is an ongoing exploration in terms of law being seen as a performance. You have been working quite a lot in this field of thinking about law as performance, but also thinking about law as text. And there is already some sort of legal tradition, but there is already an engagement with thinking beyond law only as a text, but also as a performance, and also, and now there is this sort of notion of sound that probably resonates with somehow the emergence of sound across different disciplines. So certainly sound resonates with law. What I would like just to kind of stress here is that, and why sound and why I'm using maybe this work or what this work makes me think about sound, that very often the legal scholarship currently, for all the right reasons, engages with sound either as an object of observation, can be, I don't know, an issue of music, or it can be an object of protection. Very often also it can become an object of noise regulation, right, in a public space. So it becomes an object of regulation, but, or also very often the sound is associated with the voice, right, with the subject that says something, that the law allows for the subject to protect themselves or to voice out their concerns or rights and present. But with this work, I kind of want to challenge a little bit to try to go beyond what is given, because I think law, and I think you would agree, that law tends to objectify things, whatever sort of relation there is, whatever object there is, whatever subject there is, it's the law that actually objectifies. It says you are this and this, this object is this and this, and it's subject to this form of regulation. So I think not only law as an instrument, but also the legal discourse, we fall in the trap of actually follow the law, like, okay, let's objectify this, let's see whether it's working or not. And this work actually allows for me to think about sonic qualities that actually come before language or come before any sort of concrete. So I'm very interested in that sort of sonic quality that precedes, and I think this work allows for me to investigate that. And certainly there are a couple of other things that are kind of developed, but I think I'm kind of clear. Does that make sense? Or yes and no?
I guess because, well, I'm always, and this is not in a linear sense, but I, for some reason, maybe it's the Derridian in me, it's always the to come. For some reason, I can't get my head around that which precedes, mainly because, you know, all the deconstruction of the origin and, you know, how there can never have an actual origin. So I don't know, could you explain perhaps what a sound that precedes, or what you mean by, that?
Well, I can kind of refer more in the context. What I'm trying to say is that actually, before we actually start to think about sound, well, I'm coming from a different, I'm certainly using Michel Serre, and I'm using his way of approaching, who is actually very often interested in origins, and there is always something that precedes the origin.
Yeah. Yes.
And that sort of act of preceding an origin in many different ways, it's very often a particular gesture, that is a gesture of making a cut or making a distinction. And he's exploring this across different disciplines, but where I find the legal act par excellence is actually in creating that sort of decision or making that sort of cut. That means that law cannot exist without making a distinction between one to another, right? And by doing that very act, actually, I think that sort of act, and I'm kind of arguing that that sort of act, and I'm tracing etymologically, and I'm tracing in context of geometry, that there are certain instances that actually imply a particular sonic quality that not necessarily we are capable to grasp, or we are capable to grasp, but it's a bit different to our kind of cultural understanding of what we listen, right? And probably in order for us to understand this, we will discuss at one point about the difference between listening and hearing. Because I think listening is still a cultural construction of what we are listening, but not necessarily hearing engages with any sort of meaning creation, or not necessarily it's something that falls within what I'm kind of trying to say is that, yeah, I was quite clear. Actually, hearing, in a sense, it's not engaging with any sort of meaning making. So that means that it doesn't have to carry a particular information in order to be heard, in a way.
This is why, for the piece I wrote for you, I go away from the listening, hearing, the listening, hearing distinction, because I found that it's so, everyone seems to be saying the same thing in terms of one is more of a stable comprehension of the sound, while the other one is Nancy talks about it, straining towards a sound, like, but not comprehending, but it's still that. So that's what he would call listening. And then the hearing would be the comprehension of a particular sound. But then you seem to be saying that using the terms differently, and there are so many people that use them differently. So that's why I just got from really looking very carefully at all these distinctions that people make between listening and hearing, I decided to move towards a what I thought was a bit more neutral conception, which was attunement, mainly borrowing from Nathan Crawford's work on in his book, Theology as Improvisation. So although we do have legal scholars such as Richard Dawson, who's written on justice as attunement, but I think my interpretation is that he's using attunement slightly differently than what Crawford is and that what I do. So I guess mine would move or lie more in terms of Nancy's listening conception, but I guess trying to get away from, because as soon as we talk about listening, we seem to then talk about hearing and try and make a distinction.
Well, that's a very good point that you're making, and I completely agree. And I tend also actually to avoid that sort of distinction, because one falls, and especially if one can think about Cain. I don't know if you read, he has a very interesting engagement translating Nancy, because there are different meanings. There are four different meanings in French language. So I think it's also about translation. So one can really easily fall into trap. But listening, for me, I'm also kind of employing from Chaucer, actually, it goes beyond. Because what Nancy is doing, and I think very often law tends to do, is it is always related to creating subjectivities, right? There is always a distinction between subjects, you and the other. And I think what I want to do is also to go a little bit beyond that sort of creation of subjectivities. That means not necessarily us as subjects are capable to hear certain things as law assumes or presumes or prescribes for us to hear. So I think this kind of brings us back to some of the discussion, some of the things that I really wanted to ask. Oh, I want to ask so many things now. Oh, no. Okay. I'm probably jumping from one thing to another. Sarah, I think we should concentrate now on law, justice, and improvisation, because I think we were discussing about law and justice, form and sound. So maybe I will pose this question now. Sarah, I will return to the notion of improvisation that you have explored many times. And there is this beautiful way in which you, at the very same time, contrast, but at the very same time, you blur the existence between law and justice, and you use the notion of improvisation to actually address this. So can you just kind of clearly try to grasp that? What's the difference? And I think here also not only the notion of sound, but also listening becomes quite significant.
Yes, so many things. I guess I would like to pay tribute to the, you know, that many of my views come from not only Jacques Derrida, but also my PhD supervisor, Peter Fitzpatrick, who's a legal scholar and who really worked through the aporias that are involved in law, that law-justice distinction. But how I'll just as clearly or simplistically as I can put it, typically we have this notion of law as something that is not improvised. People expect that when they're before a judge, when decisions are made, that these decisions will not be arbitrary, that mm-hmm. they will not be based on, you know, what the judge had for breakfast, and that, line of precedent that a judge has to, at least in the common law system. I know it's different in the civil law tradition, yes. but so there is this view. But of course, lawyers, judges, and especially legal academics for the most part know that this conception is very simplistic and not really how it's done in the real life. But on the other hand, we then have this conception of improvisation, which is not, again, coming from the musicians, the artists, themselves that are musically improvising, whatever, that improvisation has no law, no structure, no rules. And again, they know this is completely, you know, ridiculous. It does have, it has to, Mingus, I use this line over and over again, but Mingus says, you know, you got to improvise on something. So in order to understand or comprehend something as improvisation, you have to know the sort of law that it's going against. And same thing with law, even though it likes to consider itself as, you know, general or universal, at the same time, every time we go before a judge or any legal decision, legal judgment is made, it's a new case, it's a new fact situation. So in both instances, either in, let's say, musical improvisation or theatrical improvisation or whatever medium we're talking about, and law, there it's a negotiation between what already exists and the potentiality of newness. And so while it can never be the exact same thing, there'd be no point in going before a judge if we knew exactly what the decision would be. And there's no possibility of complete newness, because in order to understand or comprehend this thing, whatever it is, this sound, let's say, we have to then be able to categorize. It's a negotiation between these two aspects, generality and singularity. Peter Fitzpatrick talks about determinative and responsive nature of law. And so we need both these aspects in order to comprehend something.
Thank you very much for explaining this. But now I'll just kind of pose a very provocative question and almost speculative, just for the purposes of the discussion. It's just like if we situate within this sort of context of having sound and particular structure, I would do this sort of very straight reasoning that law remains a particular structure, right? That it's a coded system of regulation or system of coded principles according to which it functions. But then you argue that justice also becomes something that is quite spontaneous and improvisational. So if I can push the discussion, would probably the sonic quality be related to justice? Can one actually apply a sonic quality of something that is kind of spontaneous and not necessarily easily graspable or controllable to justice? Yeah. I'm pushing the discussion, but just...
Thank you for that. I think, again, coming back to Derrida, his conception of justice is that it is this singularity or complete newness, which is impossible because a judge can never have all the information that they need to have in order to make the perfectly, you know, just decision. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, justice is impossible. But at the same time, it has to be, to be truly just, improvised, spontaneous. You have to take the information that is in front of you and you have to try and make a decision in relation to this particular person or this particular thing in front of you. And this is where my research in Northern Ireland in relation to family law sort of comes back to that, because we had a judge, Judge Smith, who was involved in our project. And she said, you know, especially in relation to family law, each family is unique and requires a bespoke solution. So what she does, and this is my view of what as close as we can get to justice, with a, you know, in knowing that it is impossible in the Derridean sense of as pure justice, is trying to make a decision in relation to the rules that already exist, but applying them to the uniqueness of this particular situation, this family in front of you, this litigant in front of you that is going to be completely unique. Issues of time, resources, you know,
Sorry for interrupting, but what you're actually somehow implying here is that in order for one to recognize that uniqueness, there is a demand or necessity, not demand, the necessity of actually being able to listen, right? And actually, exactly. I think that's, yeah. If, but whether law in general sense can listen, is it capable to really hear all these sort of cries or nuances? Do you think?
This is where I struggle because, I mean, Judge Smith, she talks about how the most important thing in law is not only to listen, but to represent to these people in front of her that she's listening, however that might be. You know, it might even be as simple as eye contact and that. But I know what you're saying. Like, I think she's unique. She will say she's not unique in terms of judges, but I do believe that she is very unique in her wanting to listen. But the law puts obvious constraints on listening. You have to come before a judge, you know, in a particular manner. You have to have particular papers. And in family law especially, there's a lot more self-represented litigants that are challenging these legal constraints or these legal requests to put sound in a particular form. There's so many issues in relation to that.
That's perfect. Thank you very much for this, Sarah. Maybe shall I do the sonic cue, or maybe it's better for you to do it at this point?
No, let's do yours.
Okay, so I'll just play it. I have 1 minute and a half. I'll actually play it all, then I'll try to contextualize it. So let me share this with you. It's done. How did you find it?
Annoying.
Annoying, right? It's very annoying. It's very, very annoying. And if you, it was in my house and it was completely intermittent. It will appear randomly and it will have this sort of irritating sound and then it will disappear. And then once again, and we thought that actually it's the fridge until we realized that there was this box of a used fire alarm. So this is actually the battery trying and kind of gasping for more air, if I can say, or just kind of trying to remain alive. And it becomes quite sort of noise, but it's not, of course, noise is quite irritating, but also it's not something that, you know, very often we kind of think of noise as being something that interferes, but it was related very much to the very object. And as I was kind of preparing for doing this sonic cue, I actually found, and I don't know why I'm getting into this dark, I make this sort of move, but actually I found, because it's quite rattling, right? It has the actual word that explains it's a rattling sound. But then I found that there is a particular death rattle that is when a person is dying. In the last hours, there is this sort of, because of very sort of mucus that is created, there is this sort of rattling sound that becomes very loud, where the person is not capable to hear themselves, but actually the family, if they're there, they're quite present, and then certainly becomes quite disturbing. So I'm somehow not necessarily want to, even though this is a very, one can connect in the current state of events in terms of where we are, what we are on a political scene, on social scene, on where we are, the world in general, that the alarm that was present or there to remind us of certain things is actually now, even that it's dying. And this is the final sound that it's actually trying to make. So I will refer this not so much in the notion of noise, but more in terms of identifying three different ways of listening, which I would like to come back to where we discussed. Okay. And I'm referring to Michel Serre. And he actually discusses three different kinds of the audible, right? Of something that can be heard. And the first one, it finds within the body, where actually there are this sort of murmur of all the cells, of the molecules, of the organs that not necessarily we are capable to be heard, but they are audible. So that's the first. And somehow I give this as an example of a particular body. It's a particular box that transmits a particular audible sort of matter. The second one is the one that is related to our surrounding, that we are kind of part of the nature, the world outside. That's the second type of audible. And the third one, where he situates, is actually the one that comes from the collective. So all the noise, all the hubbub silences the previous two. So as if the society in which we live, and I think this is all amplified with not only the form of us listening to each other right now, but also the way in which we use the means and technology currently in the current crisis, but both metaphorically, but also quite explicitly and factually, the society actually creates this sort of murmur that we are not able to even hear ourselves. So I'm making this sort of discussion just to raise where law stands here, or in terms of whether law adds to this noise, whether law or justice are means that can actually protect us from this. I don't think so we have a clear answer, but I'm just throwing it at us to somehow think of the potentials for whether law in general is a means that actually tries to silence in order to be able to regulate, to create this sort of contact in order to establish the collective. Well, I know how I argue. I argue that actually law, it's noise in itself, because at the very same time, it creates the conditions for relation to take place, for communication to take place, but at the very same time, interferes the very connection that it establishes. So it's kind of, it has this sort of, I wouldn't say dual, but it has this sort of ambiguous, and I think that's the significance of law and also how it relates to justice. Does it make sense what I'm kind of trying to?
Yes, but just hearing that noise, it made me so much think about Kafka's, you know, short story Advocates, where law is always an unlocatable droning noise. It's always there, yet at least in Kafka's tales, you know, Before the Law, yes, and all these other, you know, it's you can't actually get to it, which perhaps we can, you know, give the, you know, instead of that law, maybe that's justice. I don't know. Well, you know, the thing that we can never actually get before. But yeah, this idea that law is ever or omnipresent, yet at the same time, we can never actually know what it is, and perhaps materially, or, you know, as an object. And so I don't know, it just made me think, you know, that noise is law, and then how you brought it to the present situation, and yeah, the death rattle, and it's just like, in my head.
There are a lot of layers, and I'm kind of probably it's overwhelming, and I don't think so. It has a purpose to actually have a conclusive. I think it allows for us to be overwhelmed, and we are already overwhelmed, right?
Yes.
On so many different levels. But let me just come back, because this is a point that I really wanted to make it very clear, because you mentioned earlier in terms of the law being non-locatable. And I think one of the purposes, I'm returning back to that sort of object of the books.
Yes.
And actually, in my view, I take sound and law, both of them, I read them as they share some sort of qualities in terms of being both elusive, intangible, not locatable, as you say, but also at the very same time, quite material, right? Quite present, quite annoying, or quite irritating, or actually as we felt it at this point. So I think that's something in my own way of thinking I want to kind of question. And in that sense, if you allow me just to kind of contextualize, my approach to law and sound is also, at this point, sound becomes also a method of sort to think about law. So it's not only an object that we're going to regulate, we're going to silence it, we're going to instrumentalize it if need be, right? Nowadays, even noise is used to fight gatherings, right? So one weaponizes weapon to in that sense, but more to think about sound as a method through which we can penetrate, or we can go beyond certain walls that the law itself always erects, right? It creates this sort of walls, forms, boundaries. And that's the very kind of essence of law, I think. So, yeah.
That's beautiful, beautiful way to put it. And I agree completely.
Okay.
And even the weaponization of sound in relation. Oh, goodness, shoot.
Oh, that's beautiful noise as well.
I usually don't get any phone calls, to be honest.
They know that you're recording.
Just one thing I was thinking about is the weaponization of noise, but also I've just been reading something that a friend has written on how silence is being used as a weapon also. So I get, and then when you're talking about SARS and the three the three sort of conditions or of the
audible.
And you know, the idea of the body, it made me think about, you know, John Cage's work, you know, and the idea that the body can never be silent,
exactly.
That we're always listening to it. And then when you get to the collective, immediately what I thought of was a collection of experimental or improvising musicians and the sounds that they can make. And then it gets back to listening, you know, whether this sound is quote unquote beautiful or not is really in relation to not only if their listening skills, but also their sometimes non-listening skills and their attempts to break through or do something that goes against what everyone expected. So I'm not explaining this very well at all, you've just brought up so many ideas.
No, I really appreciate that. I think actually throwing these sort of thoughts are quite important, because I think it remains a great challenge for everyone, but I'm talking from our own discipline in terms of, it's not easy to grasp things that are intangible, right?
Yeah.
And I think law and sound in that sense are always open to further sort of exploration in order to be grasped, not for the purposes to grasp them and contain them, but to grasp them in order to to apprehend them, in order to comprehend them in a way. I really appreciate your thought. Maybe we can go with your sonic cue now.
Okay.
Okay.
Heard that?
I heard that.
Okay.
That so was what just, is this?
Yeah. So it's a very short selection of George Lewis's 1984 piece Rainbow Family, which as a plug for George, it has never been put on record before, mm-hmm. but it is coming out on October 30th, 2020 with Carrier Records. You can get it on Bandcamp if anyone's interested. But the reason, okay, so it's a piece or pieces that are made with both human and computer musicians. Or what George calls creative machines. So what he did at the time, and he's continued to do with other things such as Voyager, is that he's been able to program computers such that not only can they listen and respond to the musical outputs of the other musicians, but they can also actually offer their own unique inputs or, you know, in relation to a particular piece of music. And so I find this absolutely fascinating. And the reason is that it does actually come back to my work on family law and Judge Smith and her provocation regarding listening, because my question then is, and talking about the times we live in, and this is even, I was thinking about this pre-COVID, but so much of law is going online, especially family law. And can machines ever truly listen to the uniqueness of the circumstances such that they can offer a just decision? So this has been something that I've been struggling with for several years. And I was very skeptical about this possibility, but after reading and listening to George Lewis's work, I'm less skeptical.
But why is that?
Because I think he's proven that machines can improvise. And if we can then figure out a way to have them improvise in law, then that would be, to me, the possibility of justice in law. There's still, I mean, there's many, many, many problems with what I'm saying. And I'm really attentive to all the problems of technology and algorithmic, you know, listening.
And coding prescribed way of listening.
Exactly. So I'm very attentive to that, but I do have a bit of research funding to start looking at this in a bit more, you know, sort of practical detail with the view to figuring out, can machine judges actually be just? That's sort of the question.
That's amazing. And I really like, it's fascinating actually to think, and I really like also the hope that it's given in your project, right? Because it's so easy for us to actually put the coding of those technology within the sort of negative side of things. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate your openness in exploring this. But there are a couple of things that I kind of want to return to. It's just like, I'm just loudly thinking and I'm speculating in terms of, you know, the extent to which we were discussing whether law can listen or not, and whether it can listen and respond. Yeah. And then we are having this sort of machine, which is a code, and I'm playing with the words of code and being a prescribed system, whether it can listen or whether it can listen and respond. And I think that's the ongoing question. I think by answering that also, you might actually think about law, because, well, that's a completely different discussion, whether law is an artificial construction or whether it kind of comes, one can argue certainly it's an artificial construction, but I think it's also, there is this sort of essential way of whatever we do, there is always this sort of act of deciding, right? Of making a distinction between those things. So I think in that sense, yeah, distinction is a legislative act in itself. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm loudly thinking and I'm maybe digressing, but let me come back to this sort of notion of listening and responding, because I find it fascinating for us to answer that. Let's kind of try for you and I. Do you think law can really listen and respond? Because
but as you have pointed out so many times, like it only listens and responds to what it has, in a sense, pre-established as the methods of sound and speaking and so.
Or even recognizing the subject, right? Because only if you're not recognized by law, nobody would be able to hear you, right?
Exactly,
so we have those examples with the current crisis of.
But this comes from my work, like with critical improvisation scholars, and that they're always. I always have this hopefulness that even in those moments where, law determines, how and where and why and to listen, at the same time, there's always those potential disruptions and those sounds that might be, somewhat inaudible, but it does, it hits something. And so I always believe that. Yeah, this is this idea of attunement as an imperfect listening to the other, that it is always, we can never actually hear the other because the essence of otherness is such that it can't be heard. But there, in the straining towards listening to the other, that I think there's the possibility of something happening. I am optimistic person, so
You should, and I'm allow me to return, but I think now it's also quite crucial because I'm returning again to this notion, because I really like how Michel Serre develops this sort of notion of listening that actually goes beyond the ear. He contextualizes as boxes, actually, and he identifies these boxes similarly as we discussed before. Molecule to molecule, cell to cell, there are boxes that are kind of transmitting information, and that act of transmission and response for Serre actually is an act of hearing. So that sort of transmission of content at the very same time happens on a social level. So not only in a natural body, but on a social level. So he argues, or that's how I argue, in a sense that we create various sort of institutions, like conceptual, but also material institutions, and one of those can be argued to be law, that creates ways in which we can listen. So I think that's where we always situate. We always have to challenge, but also at the very same time acknowledge that law creates those conditions in which people can listen, or not people, subjects, or even we are capable to hear objects, because that's also... quite important that law has an extent to even recognize objects or that matter as a subject of, matter, in a sense like inanimate matter, I meant.
This is making me think again about George Lewis's work on machine listening, because what he makes very obvious, I know that there's so much work being done about, the algorithms that are utilized are, racist, sexist, classist and that. But what George did with his Voyageur, which came after Rainbow Family, is he programmed the machine with what he calls an African-American sensibility. So he was moving, he was explicitly trying to figure out what sort of programmable things you could put in relation to African rhythms and things like that. So it's a very, and he's very explicit about this. And so what's needed perhaps, and what I'm taking from what you just said, is that some sort of more explicit acknowledgement of how law is in a sense programmed in a particular way, to listen in a particular way, to accept sound in a particular way. My thought is that if we're talking about machine judges, is that there has to be a very explicit acknowledgement, I think, of what you're actually doing. Because the problem is machines are often seen as neutral, right? Just as judges are often seen as neutral. And this is not the case.
So how do we
make it more explicit as to what is actually being done, or what sensibility are we putting into this particular program or into law? So I'm just rambling, but
I really everything makes sense, and it just I'm actually enjoying listening to you and thinking about these things that I actually haven't, but I really enjoyed the way in which somehow all these sort of different thoughts are coming together. And I don't know if this makes sense to anyone, but I really do enjoy of having this chance to actually think about these things that we are constantly actually touching upon. Is there anything that we haven't looked at?
I don't think so.
No, I think we've covered more or less everything.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Duška Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Bano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Duška Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.